Welcome back, everybody, to the latest episode of the New Liars Show. I'm David Gosson, your host. And today we're doing a roundtable. So we have some special guests, two guests. Adam Cedia, our regular contributor, is back. Welcome, Adam.
Good to be back.
And Adam in Indiana. And we have our good friend and also regular contributor to The Chained Muse and New Liar Magazine, Daniel Leach, down in Texas. Welcome, Adam. Daniel.
No, good to be here.
So we're continuing our journey, which started last week, where the latest issue of New Liar has come out. A lot of fine stuff. You know, we were getting carried away just talking about, you know, what we were going to talk about 2 seconds ago here. This is the fourth issue, which is fun. It's how time goes by. And each one really has its own theme. Each one is its own journey, which is nice. So the theme of this issue is really a renaissance. What does that mean? I think it's a fair question, especially today when we consider all the chaos and confusion in the world, and people are looking for an anchor, right? For something to anchor themselves in, you know. What do we look to? And as soon as we go down that road, people have all sorts of ideas. And we could talk about it for a long time, but I think it helps to, you know, today there's a lot of criticism. There are a lot of polemics, essays talking about what should happen, but what does the real thing actually look like instead of just talking about it? So, I mean, this is why we publish New Liar, which is, I mean, this issue has 150 pages. A lot of original poetry by both new and seasoned voices, all very talented. So we're going to dive right in. And I mean, with that, I would just say last time we opened with, we talked about Schiller's poem, Words of Delusion, and this whole idea of a golden age that seems to, is always a recurring theme. There was some golden age, either in the past or in the future, and mankind has to get back to that. And there are all sorts of ideas about what that is. But in Schiller's poem, he cautions people that as long as some golden age is something that people imagine as being in the distant past or in the distant future, evil's always going to triumph. You know, it's always just going to find a way to trick people. And finally, the turn in the poem is that really that golden age, the deeper truth, awaits within. It's there if we're ready to listen or ready to let it find us. So, I mean, how are you guys reacting to the issue or what I just said? Dan, I should mention, just came back recently from Florence and Rome. And you might have some impressions, Dan, based on that then and now today. Did you get
this is particularly poignant in my mind right now, because I just before we started I was reading Adam's essay on a Renaissance, not an Enlightenment, and had just reread my own posting from Florence that is also printed in this issue. They actually work quite nicely together. And I think, you know, the thing that impressed me more than anything else, I mean, I've always been a devotee of Renaissance humanism, most of my, you know, adult life, although I'm not anywhere near as scholarly as Adam is in as well-versed in the philosophy and all the poetry and everything. I've sort of zeroed in on Dante and a few others. But the thing that really impresses one when you're there at the epicenter of the Renaissance, which is often referred to as the Golden Renaissance or the Florentine Renaissance, because Florence is where it really began, you're impressed with exactly what you're referring to. That although this was a revival, a rebirth, which is what Renaissance means. It was a rebirth of the ancient knowledge, particularly Plato and the Greeks, to a lesser extent, the Roman philosophers and poets. But it was very much the driving passion of the key geniuses within it, particularly people like Brunelleschi at the early phase, later on Boccaccio and Leonardo. But it was their driving passion to improve mankind's condition and to create a better future in which knowledge and the potential beauty of the human mind, because it can reflect the divine, which is really the essence of Renaissance art, would be available to everyone. Right? This was a inherently republican ideal embedded within the art of the Florentine Renaissance and also the literary works. So I think this goes very much to the issue that you're raising, that Schiller's poem raised. Merely looking back is not enough. This is what is the problem, for example, with the Pre-Raphaelites of the 19th century. That's what they were all about, looking back to a previous age. Of course, they chose the age. They called themselves the Pre-Raphaelites because they thought the paradigm of virtue was before the Renaissance, feudalism, right? And this is what I think is wrong with some of our conservative, so-called conservative literary colleagues today on certain websites and publications, who want to preserve the form, of past times in poetry, but don't have this driving passion to create a better future. And so to me, that is kind of the essence of the matter. And it really comes from an attitude of the heart. It comes from what Christians identify as agape, which is a love of humanity for the sake of God, the love of the divine within human beings. Mm. So I think this, to me, is very much at the center of the issue of creating a new Renaissance, which is what we're trying in our small way to contribute towards.
Yeah, we're trying to have fun.
To build, it's always fun. Just to build on that, though, that's exactly what the Renaissance itself was. It wasn't a simple resurrection of the classical world. There was a recognition at the same time that the classical world was dead and it was pagan, and we weren't going to go back to the pagan days of Greece and Rome. And there was serious conflict over that. For example, depictions of mythology or scenes from classical mythology and art. many Christians and Christian leaders at the time considered that idolatry, or certain ancient Greek practices that I won't mention that will get us banned on YouTube. That was a huge issue in the Renaissance. Those currents of perhaps too literal a resurrection of the classical world never overtook the general trend, because there was that recognition that, yes, we're taking the best of what came before, but at the same time, we live in our own age, a Christian age, where there, as much as we would like, there is no Roman Empire. We speak different languages. We may study Greek and Latin and inscribe them, but we are writing literature in what only a couple centuries ago was simply bad Latin. There was that respect for the past, but at the same time, very much an awareness of the present and a desire to build a better future.
Right. And I mean, that's a combined mouthful what you guys just said. I mean, we're going to be hashing that out for a while. But yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I mean, so many points here, but the first thing, yeah, maybe just generally speaking, right, the whole Renaissance ideal, I think contrast helps, right? Like what was before, what was after, what are the qualitative distinctions between what was before and what occurred with the Renaissance? We can look at it in many different ways from the language, right? Petrarch, Boccaccio. Boccaccio's a pretty interesting case, right? The Decameron is a whole new series of stories in the vernacular, a new series of myths, things that people can tell, right? And what's funny is, well, I mean, they're funny. And there's a lot of moral teachings and lessons that are conveyed in very funny and amusing ways, body ways and all sorts of things that people would actually tell. And if you can laugh about something, you know, that's always good. You know, in hypnosis, they have pattern interrupts, you know, where people, you might have a thought or something that freaks you out or that you're obsessing about and it can't seem to go away. And they have something called pattern interrupts where you kind of bring it to the extreme where finally people just break out laughing because it's just crazy. And I find you see that with a good story, a good comedy, where people can laugh at themselves and break away from their own silly conceptions. But that's just one example. But the idea is they weren't just trying to all learn Latin and Greek and write new Latin and Greek stories, right? They were actually developing their own language culture, which, I mean, if we're going to have a Renaissance today, the same kind of thing is going to happen. So it's going to have to be in the vernacular of today. And it's going to have to, this is why I think the idea of timelessness is useful. You know, that the principles are immutable, the unchanging principles that govern the universe, they're not going away. The natural laws of the universe are not going away. But I think true creative genius is a question of how the artist is able to, or thinker is able to capture these ideals, these principles uniquely within their own age. You know, so Schiller says, the artist is a son of his age, but pity him if he's also its pupil. You know, let him be suckled by the milk of a better age. Ultimately, he says, nay, beyond all time, right? And into the realm of timelessness. And so there's the changing, right? We're in a constantly changing world of flux, but there are universal principles that govern that process at all times. And so how we wed those two incommensurable worlds, how they collide, I mean, that's where we really get a true genius, I think. And so in the Renaissance, we have many interesting examples of that. And they take different forms, as Adam, you said, even, you know, some of the artists are depicting Greek themes. And yeah, certain people are saying, hey, that's not exactly you know, the most Christian thing or what we're going for. And there's a different concept, there are different ideas. But I think the central Renaissance idea is imago viva Dei, capax Dei, that man is in the unique image of God. Every individual is a unique image of God. And that has to be unearthed. And every individual has to develop their capacities and has a right, should have access to the basic resources and situation where they can develop to their fullest potential, understanding that this divine spark is a sacred thing, then it must be allowed to develop and to be nourished as much as possible. So it's not up to a hereditary class of hereditary blue bloods, right, who, you know, this sacredness is something that's you're sort of endowed with thanks to your blood, or, you know, how long, you know, your grandparents have, you know, owned land.
Or even worse than that, I think, is the idea of secret knowledge or gnosis, or somehow that your ability, your privilege, so to speak, is based on your initiation into an understanding that's not accessible outside of your particular circle.
Yeah, and there were those in the Renaissance times as well, as much as in ancient Greece. And that's why some people, you know, have different reactions, right? When people talk about the Renaissance as this great time, you know, they say, well, there is actually a lot of weird stuff too. Fair enough. But that's why it's important, I think, to be clear about what the essential qualitative shift was, which was that every individual has this sacred spark. And, you know, contrary to the previous ages, you could say, if we're looking at trying to understand this epistemological and spiritual shift in man, in the conception of man, compared to what preceded it, you know, you could say you had the icons, right? Art before the Renaissance, you know, things, they were big on the icons. And so divinity is this often portrayed in the art, if we're considering the treatment, as very static images, right? These distant icons, something that divinity is something we worship at a distance.
It's unapproachable.
Yeah, it's infinite, because the divine is, and this is an Aristotelian way to think about it. The divine is infinitely far, right? Because the divine and the finite are logically they're contradictory. You can't, how can the two meet? If the divine is infinite and, you know, the earthly is finite, there's an incommensurable gulf between the two. And so I think you see this in the art, and with the Renaissance, you get this shift where the divine is much more embodied, and there's an emphasis on that.
We have a different problem today in what we're trying to do with these podcasts and with the new lyre and with the chained muse, which is related, which is we live in an age now which has been very much characterized, I think, by this solipsism that Adam identified in one of his essays, idea of an individual as separate from and important only in and of itself, and therefore every experience, every emotion of that individual as an individual is worthy of expression, as opposed to this, the Renaissance idea, which is that the individual is important precisely because we are a microcosm of the divine. We're a microcosm of God and of the entire universe. And when that informs the intention of the artist or the, you know, the poet, in this case, they're actually seeking to touch that which is universal in everyone else, because they recognize it within themselves, rather than simply proclaiming themselves as, you know, the center of the universe. It's two completely different ideas. And I think what we're seeing in some of the young poets that, you know, that, you know, David, you've been able to discover and give a voice to on the site, is a certain desire, a passion to get back to that idea of addressing that which is universal in an experience or in one's own internal emotions. This is, I think, really important, because this the age in which we live in is so, it's become so disconnected from this idea, that I think this is, you know, goes to the center of a lot of the ills of society right now. Identity politics, you know, it's all based on that concept of the individual.
Yeah, I mean, I could say a lot right there. Adam, I think you wanted to chime in before. And
Well, there was a lot there. Elsewhere I've heard that called radical individualism, and I think that's a good nomenclature to assign it, to contrast it with the sort of humanistic individualism we see in the Renaissance, which by and large is a positive development. Here we've gone, I agree with Daniel, we've gone way too much the other way. and it's gotten to the point, to bring technique into it, you know, it hasn't infected just the ideas that contemporary poetry expresses, but in the absolute ruination of technique and style. Because after all, who is anyone else to question craftsmanship? You know, who are, you know, if the individual is paramount, then how they choose to express themselves is beyond criticism. And thus you get free verse, not as an experimentation or, in some ways intimately tied in with the expression, but you get free verse as pure sloppiness masked with the or fortified with the argument of who are you to criticize?
Yeah. Whereas a real commitment to craftsmanship, if it's done from the right standpoint, is an expression of respect for your reader, because you are making the effort to make your thoughts accessible to them through, you know, a commonly shared language, which does not mean, you know, that you have to be literal, because the use of metaphor stimulates, you know, actual ability of the mind to, you know, to contain an actual idea, which is immaterial, right? And when poetry does that through metaphor, and metaphors, of course, can only be expressed in terms of paradoxes and juxtapositions, when it stimulates the ability for the mind to actually see to behold a concept, a pure idea, that's something very special. It's kind of a shared spiritual experience between the artist and the listener. The what Adam's referring to is simply saying, I can throw anything I want to on a page, you know, without any, without any concern whether you actually understand it or not, whether it actually refers to anything common between us, and you have to respect it.
That's a very good point. And I would liken it to, you know, if I want to build a table for someone, you bet you I would learn how to saw wood properly against the grain, and, you know, how to nail join and measure. And it takes a lot of time and effort, but I'm doing it ultimately for the person who's going to be using that table. Yet I wouldn't just throw together random pieces of wood and say, if you don't appreciate this, you don't understand me. It wouldn't make sense in any other field except the arts, unfortunately. And that's where we find ourselves.
I would add, and that's a fine point. And I mean, to build on that, number one, meta means really going back to the Greek, to transport, right? So metaphor is something that's taking you from one thing to another, right? So you have a simple image, you know, and that's developed. There's a richness of meaning, and it takes us places. You know, I personally like, you know, the story of Icarus flying too close to the sun, right? Because that's just, I mean, you could revisit that over and over. Does man always have to fly too close to the sun? And there's just so much richness and nuance if you explore that story and that myth. And, you know, does man always have to fly too close to the sun? If we're looking at what's going on right now in history, we might be asking ourselves that question, you know, do people always have to hit rock bottom? Does civilization always have to, you know, totally collapse before there's a rebirth? You know, we could entertain that for a long time. But also, I mean, when I think of this idea of beauty and craftsmanship, I think on a certain level, it's the idea that beauty is objective is liberating. But more, I'd say, I would qualify that to say there are objective criteria, as Shirley would say. Beauty is subjective, but there are objective criteria by which to judge or to create that subjective experience. Which is true. I think if we look at any piece of art, the artist is creating the effect, what seemed like a magical effect, right? You could say any great work of art has a certain magic, a certain, you know, Dana Gioia, former poet laureate of California, a very fine poet, you know, he talks about poetry and enchantment. that poetry really puts people in a light trance. You know, it brings you into a certain space where certain things become possible that are not possible if we're just thinking in purely material, literal, or literal terms of thinking. So with that said, I think beauty is liberating. That idea of beauty is liberating because it is objective. It doesn't matter if you're black or white or if you're this or that. All these things don't matter. If the art is good, it's good. We don't need to know what your education was, what your birth was, your background, your rearing, how much money you have. It all doesn't matter. What matters is if it's actually good or not. And I think that's a very freeing conception, you know, and that's been somehow perverted and turned into actually, no, it's oppressive. But I mean, that's because there is this radical individual idea, which ultimately impoverishes us, I would say, because in a sense, it narrows the sphere of our experience and understanding. And I mean, you know, I'm a big fan of Tim Dillon, who's a podcaster. And I mean, he says a lot of funny stuff with a lot of wisdom in it. And he makes a joke where he says, be more Asian. You know, your emotions are impoverishing you. You know, in our Western society, right, everything is about me and like my time and da-da-da. But that can be overdone, right? If every emotion and every thought needs our full attention, I mean, we become impoverished, right? We become stuck in our heads, obsessed with our emotions, and that limits our ability to make breakthroughs and to change and to transform and to develop and to put ourselves in the position of people who are completely different than us. And I mean, we could go down the rabbit hole in the sense that the extreme of that is the Luciferian idea, which is the worship of self. Right. So, and that's the concern that some, I'd say, you know, more orthodox thinkers within the church, the church, or just orthodox thinking in general, is the idea that man becomes at the center of the universe. And so the idea of Imago Viva Dei or Capax Dei, that you had with the Renaissance, can be construed as the idea that man can become God. Right. And so this is linked with transhumanism today. But I think that's an epistemological question. And, you know, like, are we reading just the letter or also understanding the spirit at the same time, in that if man is in the image of God, then he should be able to do godly things. Right. But just because he can do godly things, that doesn't mean he is God. And that's the qualitative distinction. And, you know, you got pretty much two churches quarreling over certain epistemological aspects of things like that. But I think it's important to keep that question of Dumas in mind when we're thinking about what that means and the implications. You know, if it's overly centered on man and the individual, yeah, you're going to have problems. If it's overly centered on some abstract, you know, doctrinal idea of divinity, and then when you actually run into your neighbor or your fellow man, there's kind of a distance and you're not able to see that spark in them. There's also a lot of implications, right? And everything has to be, things get pretty sticky. You know, how do you get people to fall in line? If people, you know, are we speaking to that deeper thing in people, or ultimately are we just reverting to a sophisticated form of dog training? You know, dog goes place A, gets punished. Dog goes place B, gets rewarded. Dog knows that place A is bad and place B is good. That's basically Aristotelian logic. That's ratiocination, as they would say, ratio, comparative knowledge. And Cusa makes the point, Nicholas of Cusa, who is, you know, arguably the greatest Renaissance mind, that to truly conceptualize the nature of God, the nature of the divine, the laws of the universe, one has to go beyond comparative knowledge from quantity, that is, to quality, right? And to actually conceptualize what are the qualities of of divinity, right? What are the qualities of Capax Dei and being Imago Viva Dei? That makes for a lot of good art, right? If we start exploring that kind of thing. That was a long rant, but yeah, some of the thoughts that were provoked by.
Maybe we should explore something.
Yeah, I'm just seeing. Is Adam there as well? I'm just seeing you, Dan.
You can hear me?
Yeah,
I can see.
Yeah, I can see you. I mean, let's read some poems, actually. That was the other thought I had.
Mm-hmm.
We said people are just talking about it, and we just started to talk about all this stuff. So with that long-winded doctrinal prelude, what poem would people like to or think would be a nice opener based on what you've already read? Birch?
Yeah.
Or do I start with Petrarch and that translation? Because we do have a rich translation section. Which one do you guys vote on?
I would prefer an original work myself.
Let's do it. Okay. So Michael Birch, I mean, he always gets so much airtime. Gosh. But yeah, he just knows how to capture people's attention, right? And again, one could say it's not arbitrary, right? Somebody who's writing good poems consistently, I mean, they know what they're doing. So this one's called In the Whispering Night. And then you guys can maybe talk about why it captured your attention. So Birch actually wrote this for one of his college English teachers. He tells a funny story about that whole thing. But yeah, let's just say the poetry was very, the teacher was very enthusiastic about poetry. In the whispering night, when the stars bend low till the hills ignite to a shining flame, when a shower of meteors streaks the sky and the lilies sigh in their beds for shame, we must steal our souls as they once were stolen and gather our vigor and all our intent. We must heave our bodies to some violent ocean and laugh as they shatter and never repent. We must dance in the darkness as stars dance before us, soar, soar through the midnight on a butterfly's breeze, blown high, upward yearning, twin spirits returning to the world of resplendence from which we were seized.
I like this very opener. I like this very much. It's very much to my own tendencies in poetry. First of all, what sticks out about it is it has a very beautiful and lulling kind of rhythm to it. It's for the most part anapestic, two short and one long syllable, which
in the whispering night.
In the whispering night, when the stars bend low, till the hills ignite to a shining flame, when a shower of meteors streaks the sky, it has a beautiful flow to it. First of all, that's the rhythm that Poe dearly liked. Was many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea, there lived a maiden which we all know by the name of Annabel Lee. It that's the first thing that stands out, but it contains an idea which I think is very, very beautiful in itself, and the way he develops it is very beautiful. We are immortal beings beyond the physical. That's our true identity. That's our home, and we were stolen away from that to be encased in these bodies, and that in order to experience. Together, in this case, he's exhorting the the other of this poem to make this return to this spiritual being together by together annulling the body, throwing it against you know into a violent ocean, and then soaring. And I think it's just and the this image of the butterfly wings on a breeze, it reminds me very much of Keats when he says, you know, away, away, for I will fly to thee, not a chariot on the by the Bach, the
Bacchus and his pards.
And his pards, but on the viewless wings of poesy.
And right? The dull brain perplexes and
returns. A certain point when you've gone through the here he does, he accomplishes very, very economically in just a few lines. But once you've made that transition to reject the, you know, the mortal, it's effortless because you are of this, essentially of this spiritual nature. And soar through the night on a butterfly's breeze, blown high, upward yearning, twin spirits returning to the world of resplendence from which we idea, the world of resplendence, you know. So I think here in just what is it, just 12 lines, it's not a sonnet, it's just 12 lines, he's accomplished something very much like what I think Keats does in his Ode to a Nightingale.
It does. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of things we could say here. And I mean, as a little anecdote thing, I mean, Birch says he never thought about meter writing any of his poems. That's why I'm like, get out of here. I mean, this is, I mean, he just did, but he's got a natural, you can tell. I mean, there's, he wrote this when he was in his early 20s. I mean, so this is not, yeah. So there's a natural talent there. And it's nice to, you know, it's got form, it's got meter. It's in no way limiting the talent in any, if anything, it is. It's making all of it all the more miraculous. It's making the idea clearer because there are these clear contrasts in images, right? And stanzas, and that makes the development clear such that we can actually internalize it and reproduce it, right? In our minds, in our hearts. And I think that's also what's useful. It is in our minds and our hearts. This isn't just some abstract idea, but it's very visceral. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really the importance of art, is that it really is a kind of middle world, a bridge between the heart and mind, where our faculties, our senses are awakened and our passions are kindled. But at the same time, there's a clear idea. Right, there's a North Star of sorts that when we hear this, we're all kind of looking to the same place in our mind's eye, and it's a reminder, I would say, as a lot of great poetry is, and as Robert Frost put it, poetry reminds us of those things that it would impoverish us to forget. And so here, I mean, it doesn't matter where we are in our lives or how. You know, I feel like some critic might see this, right? A literary critic, and might say this is very romantic. This is very kind of a youthful passion, good for him. But then life happens and X, Y, Z. And I'm a realist now. I used to be just like you. I mean, I could just keep firing off lines like that. But actually, I mean, I like the way Schiller talks about it. You know, when in his naive and sentimental poetry essay, where he makes the point about the flower or the child, and you know, why do we admire the child? You know, what is it about the childlike awe and wonder and freedom and joy? Is it just something that's lost in the past that we can no longer enjoy? Which is not what Christ, that wasn't Christ's injunction, right? When he says you must, to enter the kingdom of heaven, truly you must become like children, right? So that certainly wasn't the way Christ thought about it either. But that, as Schiller says in his essay, they're a reminder of what we were and what we must once again become. And I think that's clear. So when I hear something like this, this is a reminder of if we've ever lost that spark, or maybe it left us for a while, this is a friendly reminder that it's still there and it's still waiting. You know, it's waiting in every soul. It's waiting in every human being. And, you know, whenever we're ready. Any thoughts before we look to another fun piece from this issue, Adam?
Well, I echo everything Daniel said. I just want to emphasize that this is a very, the craftsmanship here is of a very high quality. The rhyme, you almost have to look at it twice, and you certainly have to read through it to catch the rhyme.
That's a good point.
With the, in other words, it's not clumsy, it's natural. And Daniel made the comment about the anapestic meter. I had commented on one of Birch's other poems, Infinity. It's nice to see a deviation in English from the iamb, which is, I won't say it's difficult, but it's a little more challenging than just falling into iambs every time. And I think the almost playful nature of the subject fits well with the anapestic meter. And then in the second from last line, we have that internal rhyme, upward yearning, twin spirits returning. That's just a nice little flourish that's a real treat to the reader, I think.
It's almost got that Mozartian sort of, it's just all happening so freely and so magically. And you're just like, well, isn't that great? You know, it's just a nice, it's a little bit of magic, right?
Yeah.
Just always nice. Mm-hmm. And so why not now shift the tone a bit? I mean, we talked about what poems sort of stood out, what we liked in the issue before. I mean, Adam, your poem, Regret. I mean, I think that would be a nice one, Dan. You're the one that mentioned that it really stood out to you. And it's also a sonnet, so, you know, which was a pretty popular form back in the Renaissance day, the sonetto, right, which is a small song derived from a song, the canzone, the bigger song. And I mean, for anybody looking at or studying Italian poetry, Dante, Petrarch, you know, he's famous for the canzoniere, right, the book of songs. And, you know, Dante really pioneered that form, the canzone, chanson. In, I guess, Provençal or French, even, is pretty much the same thing, chanson. So this is in petite chanson, a small song, sonetto. So why did you like this one, Dan? Or let me read it first, or Adam, do you want to read it?
I don't mind reading. I figure you'll have an author reading.
Yeah, take it away.
Regret. You ask, do you have something you regret? I answer frankly, I can never know. The paths down which I never chose to go grow countless as my newest footprints set. Each turn prescribed the course that would beget all later turns in unrelenting flow. A path that nothing but the trek could show, with all outside it never to be met. And yet I lie to say I do not rue some steps along my way, some turns that grew into the ghosts now haunting me at night. For here my steps crushed flowers, there a friend, yet with each turn towards darkness I ascend, for without shadow who can know the light?
Yet with each turn towards darkness I ascend, for without shadow who can know the light? Fun. And it's called Regret. Fun.
It's weird to call regret fun, but you know, I'll be happy to share my thoughts on it, but I'm curious to hear what you and Daniel think.
Yeah, do we chime in first and get that you get the background, the official story after or before? Daniel, you decide. I don't know which one was better.
Well, I can say something about it. I mean, first of all, it's a very profound reflection on something that we all have to think about. First of all, and it's presented in a very well crafted form, because this is, after all, Petrarchan or Italian sonnet. You know, it's divided into two quatrains and then the sestet, which, you know, moves towards an ending. You present an idea in the first four lines, then a slightly different idea in the second four lines, and then develop it towards its conclusion, which all sonnets of this type do, and that's or should, you know, if you're actually thinking about it. So, you know, this question, do you regret anything? And, you know, simply answering that, I cannot know, because I was led down paths in my life which led me in such a way that I don't know what those things were that could have been different. And each turn prescribed the course that would beget all later turns in unrelenting flow. I've sort of been the victim of these circumstances of life. And then introducing the idea that, but I cannot say that there aren't some things I have that I do regret, some you know, some bad turns, some things that said that might have hurt someone, the things that haunt all of us at night. You know, I think this is a very universal thing. But then the concluding idea that with each turn in life, if one is wise and one is learning from it, that you progress to in your spiritual development, that you learn from the darkness and ascend towards the light, that this is the lot of life. We cannot escape, but if we're wise, we're actually yearning towards this higher version of ourselves, you might say, and you can't have it without the shadow. I think it's a very profound idea. It's presented in a way which is, you know, I think the form is perfectly married to it, but without ever appearing to be artificial or forced. This is very important, because I've seen sonnets, you know, written by modern authors that just sound, they're trying to imitate Shakespeare, or, you know, usually that's usually their where it comes from. They're trying to sound like Shakespeare, or, you know, or be too perfect. This is very natural and presents a very simple but very profound idea.
Right. I mean, and we could go at this at all sorts of different levels as well. I mean, even just technically the first two lines, you ask, do you have something you regret? I answer frankly, I can never know. Just technically the rhyme that's then created with the next two lines, regret, no, it's literally sounds like echo. But if we're thinking about the vowels, right, and that understanding that poetry is something to be sung, right, and recited, do you ask, do you have something you regret? I answer frankly, I can never know. And there's already two voices, which is nice. The paths down which I never chose to go grow countless is my newest footprint set. So you literally have this sound of echo in terms of the vowels, the richness of the vowels literally echoing through the rhyme, which is nice. And I mean, we could keep going. But so the music is there. And I mean, without the music, you don't have poetry. Mm-hmm. So that's always, I think, important to remember. Whereas Dana Joya points out in some of his talks, you know, made the point that, you know, he's written some libretti and spoken about, you know, when people talk about the Italians, when they were talking about composing libretti, libretto, they'd say, prima la musica, dopo le parole. So first the music, then the words. And I mean, I've listened to enough interviews and, you know, I'm always poking around. Even if you hear some of the very popular and talented popular musicians of the last, whatever, few decades, I remember hearing Kurt Cobain saying, like, first it's a song. It's a melody that comes to you and the words come after. And, you know, they may make sense at different levels or to varying degrees, but you have a melody and then the words sort of find the melody, but the melody has to find you first. And so when we have that rhythm, then we start to get to a deeper thing.
I think this is an important point. And I think Adam understands this because he writes music. Because he writes music, but music in poetry is essential, I think, because there's no way to set off the comparison of one thing to another, a juxtaposition or a paradox, or show a development in an idea without the mind being able to see, you know, that something's, it has the same musical quality as the line that went before it, but what has changed? It forces the mind to consider what is changing here in a way that you cannot do without the form, without the music. I think this is the essence of what actual poetry is. It's not just metaphors which exist, you know, outside of the terms of the, you know, the words themselves, an idea in the Platonic sense of it that stimulates the imagination to, you know, into a higher realm, but it shows a development in that idea, however simple, which in a sonnet has to be somewhat simple because you've only got 14 lines to do it. You can have something presented in, you know, in two or three different, you know, terms. So but I think this cannot be accomplished without music. This is the essence of why poetry is different than prose. And as you know, as someone said, I forget who, you know, if it's better said in prose, write it in prose.
Fair enough. I mean, as I'm hearing that, though, you say this is the essence of all poetry, the musical aspect as well. And it's like, well, this is the essence of all thought, really, that contrast, mm-hmm. right, of the different, that there's something similar in terms of the form, but yet there's something different. And our mind is made aware of that. And that contrast awakens the mind, really, right? The irony is what the mind actually turns on, as opposed to just receiving a constant flux of impressions and just taking it all in. The contrast, or which you could say has a formal quality to it, kindles that awareness. And I mean, so at its highest level, all great thought has a musicality to it, right, in terms of how it develops and changes and reveals something deeper. So we can't really get away from that. And I think that's the beautiful thing, like that's actually how it works. So we should probably study the greatest composers and the greatest poets. You know, who knows where it'll take us, where it'll take mankind, you know, if we actually take that stuff seriously.
Well, and on a science, just to chime in here, on a scientific level, music is a pattern. Otherwise, it's just noise. I mean, you can see that, you know, graphically represented.
Good point.
So to say that, to divorce the idea of poetry from pattern, it is to remove its essence, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's a fine, That was put in the simplest and most economical terms. That was a very fine point. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So number one, how are we doing for time? We definitely
right, we just hit another... 10 minutes.
So we got again another poem. How are you doing for time, Adam? If we go into like,
I don't think we can do a full 40 minutes, but I can probably go maybe sure, another okay. half an hour.
Yeah. Okay. So here, let's start another one. I mean, I think we're, again, this is 150 pages. I mean, this is the problem with this show. I mean, we could, we're just scratching the surface. I mean, we could go on and we're all technically holding back here. I have, for every point that I made, I had five others. But we all liked Radiance by Daniel Platt, P-L-A-T-T, who is a translator, poet, and musician who resides in Los Angeles, California. That's what his bio says. And so, I mean, I'll just read this one and then you guys can react because you both liked it. It's also a sonnet. So we're on the sonnet train and we may as well keep going. I mean, there's a lot of fine sonnets. I think there's like 15, 20 sonnets in this issue. I'm not sure. If we count the translations, there's definitely, there's probably 20 sonnets in here. So, and we'll probably end, I think, with a translation. I think we'll have a good one to just end. So Daniel Platt, this one's called Radiance. A half-life passes, others come and go, but no clairvoyant eyes can find the day when what we've shared will finally ebb away. Our palate lacks the muted indigo, a shade to quench the incandescent glow. Our cataclysms, radiant decay, and time provides no twilight to allay the swelter as the burnished memories flow. Our sin was unoriginal, and yet there was a bonding no one could explain, a synthesis of sorrow and a sweet combustion only passion could beget. And if I could embrace it once again, I'd stop my clocks and call the world complete.
Oh.
It's even nicer to hear it out loud, right? When you're staring at a page, one thing. That is really nice. And if I could embrace it once again, I'd stop my clocks and call the world complete.
What I like best about this, and I appreciate the extended metaphor of love with radioactivity and all that it implies. We have the half-life of decay. We have the clock stopping, hinting at the nuclear clock. We have the indigo that I think actinium produces in the dark, and radiant decay, talking about the glowing. I mean, there's just so much. The extended metaphor is so well done. And then I also liked the little "our sin was unoriginal," a little
play, yeah, that's great.
Play on words there.
Mm-hmm. This, I think, is, you know, I spoke before about bad attempts to imitate Shakespeare. This, I think, takes the best of what Shakespeare did, which, you know, all of his sonnets have this characteristic of an extended metaphor developed in this way, only in this case, in a completely original, you know, and it highly imaginative way, and also very beautiful way. It has perfect form, but yet avoids that artificiality that you often see in sonnets of this type. Yeah, and I think the central idea that he sort of gets to around the, you know, the line that Adam just cited, "our sin was unoriginal," he's referring to physical passion, obviously, but it contains something of a spark of something much greater to it. The synthesis of sorrow and a sweet combustion only passion could beget. And I think this, you know, that has an echo to me of, you know, of what Poe often referred to, and also Shelley, that there is something in all experience of beauty which is sorrowful, which is melancholy, because it is always passing.
Right.
And this is about passing, decay. Right? But yet, if I could embrace it once again, I'd stop my clocks and call the world complete. It's just, it's just beautiful.
You're looking at how brilliant it is, and yet the thought is that, well, look how brilliant, it's going to pass. But at the same time, as you're saying, Dan, there's that creates a transcendent experience.
And I also think this goes in a odd way to what we were discussing at the very beginning of this discussion about the longing for something in the past, and Schiller's poem, because there is something in longing for something beautiful which is dying or dead, or as Poe pointed out, there's no more beautiful idea than the death of a beautiful woman, which is kind of the extreme form of this thing. But there's something sacred about that, when it's done with this kind of intention behind it, that I think is very, very is something very attractive about this poem that speaks to that. And a Renaissance really does have to contain a longing for the essence of what was beautiful about the past, with the intention of creating something with it. In this case, he's taken that longing for what was for something that was beautiful in his experience, and giving it to you, to take forward. So, I mean, there's a lot more that could be said about this thing, but I think it is just a very fine example of a completely original modern theme treated in a way that's, I think very much modeled on the way Shakespeare wrote, but in a very free and natural kind of way. It's, I think, a great example of what we've been talking about.
Absolutely. And he's got five more rather fine sonnets in the same form, each doing something quite different and original, which is actually what's also impressive. And I think with that said, we're going to come around on the other side here. We're going to wrap it up soon, but we got a little bit more that we have to say here and look at. So I'll let you we'll reset in 2 seconds and be right back. So we're back for one final swing at it all. And I thought we'd close with a translation by Petrarch, one of the fathers of Renaissance humanism. I mean, I don't think I can emphasize enough. We have a pretty robust translation section with four different contributors, four different translators. Some have translated more than others, but I mean, we have a good selection of Dante, Petrarch, Guido Cavalcanti, who was Dante's mentor for a significant part of Dante's formative years. And we even have some stuff by Michelangelo, translated by Adam as well. So it's a rich, I'd argue that just the translation section kind of can carry the whole issue without even all the original stuff. But here, let's, this one is called Sheer Gluttony and Sleep in Idle Couches. And it's translated by John H.B. Martin. So yeah, I mean, we open by talking about the whole idea of a golden age, which was just echoing what we started discussing in the previous podcast, where everybody's always looking to some golden age, either in the past, in the future. I mean, depends who you're talking to or what culture, what background. But yeah, the whole idea that we can just imitate some other time, as well as itself, I think, it lacks something, because as much as we'd like to reproduce some past moment in time, and I mean, I think we've had this hinted at even in the poems that we read, as much as we'd like that, I mean, it doesn't actually work that way. And we actually have to go deeper within ourselves and rediscover that thing which made the thing we admire possible in the first place, but then see how or discover how that might, how we might be able to do something original, inspired by that same idea, but also that's new. And so I think with, if we look at this sonnet, I mean, I think we'll see why I'm saying what I'm saying, actually. Let's just read it. Sheer gluttony and sleep and idle couches have from the world now banished every virtue. Whence from the way, it's almost lost to purview our nature, overborne by custom slouches. And so's extinguished every light that's bounteous from heaven, through which life more humans nurtured, that it as a thing miraculous is then viewed, one who would lead from Helicon one fountain. What longing for the laurel, what for myrtle, naked and poor philosophy goes, rather, says that vile crowd to vilest game conditioned. You've little company on ways quite other. So much the more, I pray you, soul most gentle, great-hearted, not to turn from your ambition. Counsel from the father of Renaissance humanism himself. A little pep talk of sorts.
Well, the translation, I think, is very creative with its rhyming. Couches, slouches, bounteous, fountain, virtue, purview, nurtured. Those aren't words you typically see rhymed. And there's a little freedom. I wouldn't say these are quite as much as half rhymes, but there's a good deal of license taken. But I think that's it makes the poem come alive. This is almost, I'd like to read the original. I'll confess I didn't before I started this. But I wonder if it's as playful as this translation is. This does a very good job of keeping the reader's attention. But as for what the poem says, I'm always reminded, I read an article that it was about set design in movies, and it said, some set designer said, the mistake most people make in designing sets from period movies is that, let's say your movie is set in the 1950s, not everything people had then is going to be from the 50s. They'll have carryover furniture from, you know, three decades before and things like that. So you actually need a mixture of pieces to make it realistic. And the same thing can be said about the Renaissance. You know, we have, it's not all of a sudden people flipped a switch and then all of a sudden classical art was reborn and everyone was crafting these fine sonnets. You had a good carryover from the ages which preceded it and a lot of reaction against it. And I'll remind you too, you know, Savonarola's Bonfire of the Vanities, they weren't burning Boccaccios and things like that. It was what was destroyed was largely pornography. And you have to keep in mind, there was probably a good amount of that then. You know, we're talking, Petrarch is talking about the naked and poor philosophy going on, the vile crowd to vilest game conditioned. I mean, we see a lot of degradation in our own age, but, you know, it existed then too, because people are still people.
And the essence of it is still the same. He's referring here to the pleasures of the senses, to materialism, you know, very, very much at the core of what besets modern civilization, I think.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think it's actually humbling that, you know, it's the same thing back then. And I mean, you could go back to any time. I mean, I think that's important to remark, to disabuse people from this kind of idealistic, or this Schiller called it the Schwärmerei. So the dreamer, basically, right? But everything's nice in their thoughts and in their head, but when you actually look at the real world, I mean, you're going to get discouraged if you don't have that actual foundation. And if you haven't actually taken the time to develop that, right, that rootedness, that cultivation of the deeper faculties, you know, if you just have nice ideas and good intentions, you know, we wish you well, as Tim Dillon would say, but I mean, it's probably not going to work out. So just because there's a lot of ugliness and bad stuff going on, that's not an excuse to not, and so you feel compelled to address that and to reject it and to rebuke it and to make polemics against it. That's not going to get you to the real thing, right? You know, how much time do you want to invest in refuting ugliness? No amount of negation, however eloquent, you know, clever, crafty, or erudite, is going to lead, no amount of negation of ugliness will lead to beauty, will lead to genuine beauty or new discoveries. And so I think that's it's useful to keep that in mind.
And I think this,
go ahead,
this exhortation at the end, closure to, you know, to relative to what you said at the beginning about Schiller's exhortation, be the child of your age, but do not be its favorite, I think was the way he put it. I mean, what Petrarch is saying here is that you're going to be lonely if you take up this this path, and so much more. I pray you, soul most gentle, great-hearted. In other words, you have to be brave and of a big heart and more loving for that, to not turn away from this ambition. Or I would say, you know, I don't know what the Italian word is, but he's referring to a calling. So
absolutely, he calls it a path in the original. I believe it's the path, you know, don't sway from your path. Keep right.
Well, that's our word for courage comes from the French courage, from Italian coraggio, and the root word is cuore, heart.
That is,
yeah, great hearted.
I think that's actually not a bad place to conclude this discussion. I mean, we could go on for a while, but I think that's actually a fine place to conclude until we have a lot more coming. We would encourage everybody, get yourself a copy of New Liar. You know, this is something you can carry around and
reverse
it. Pardon me?
Available on Amazon.
Yeah, it's available on Amazon. Just go on the Chain News. You'll see New Liar at the top, or go directly to newliar.com, click the link. And yeah, so you get to carry this around and you can nurse it, but just like a baby, you know, you're giving it a lot of attention and you're nursing it, but in a sense, it's nursing you. You know, the more attention you give it, the child is father of man, I believe Wordsworth said. With that said, thank you everybody for listening. Thank you, Adam and Daniel, for joining us. And we will be back soon.